You can defend an entirely different view of the world with the same data that's used to defend the standard model. So whenever I can do that, I'm so there. Because as soon as you realize that the model you've been looking at maybe isn't so firm as you thought, then you're free.
Scott Adams is a man of many talents. Best-selling author behind books such as God's Debris and How to Fail at Almost Everything and Still Win Big. Serial entrepreneur currently working on a time management system called Calendar Tree. And of course, creator of one of the most successful comic strips of all time, Dilbert. But recently, Adams has been making waves at his blog, where he's writing about the persuasion tactics of current GOP presidential frontrunner Donald Trump, who Adams calls a master wizard. We sat down with Adams in his home office to talk about his Trump obsession, his political beliefs, his philosophy of failing towards success, and naturally, Dilbert.
Scott, thank you very much for talking to us.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start with something a little bit newsy, which is Donald Trump. You've been writing about him at your blog, the Scott Adams blog, and you say that it's resulted in a fivefold increase in your traffic. What's your fascination with Donald Trump, and maybe more importantly, what's the public's fascination with Donald Trump?
Well, he's a fascinating character, but my special fascination is his ability to persuade, his ability to influence. I have a background in hypnosis. I'm a trained hypnotist. I learned it years ago. And I see in Trump a level of persuasion technique that is probably invisible to the public, so I like writing about it so they know.
I was trying to think which Dilbert character Trump is most like. I was thinking Cat Burt, but then I was like, no, it's probably Loud Howard, right?
Oh, I hadn't thought about Loud Howard, but I think I would go with Dog Burt, because Dog Burt in the strip, he makes billions of dollars on a regular basis, and he never gives it back, so.
There were internet rumors for a while that you were libertarian, or there was speculation about that, and you even wrote an essay in response appropriately titled, Am I a Libertarian? And it quelled some of those rumors. But where do you position yourself politically?
I try as hard as I can not to fit in any of the labels, not to self-label and to resist anybody else's label, because I feel it affects credibility. So not only does it affect how someone else sees my opinion, because if they say, oh, he's one of them, they immediately turn off, but it would affect me internally. As soon as I join a group, as soon as I say, yeah, I'm with these people, suddenly all those things that I thought were crazy, I start convincing myself, well, I don't want to be a part of the crazy group, so maybe that crazy stuff makes sense after all. So I want to avoid all that.
If you don't want to put a label on it, are there principles that you think are best applied to the political realm or the way that governments or officials within government should operate?
Yeah, I hate to sound like a Trump supporter here, but my preferred political process would be something like business. Now, what does business do all the time? They test things small that make sense. At least that thing they're testing should work. You know, it sounds good on paper, but they don't know, so they test it small. We could do that with states. All right, the states can test just about anything, and then the federal government can say, hey, look at the results. If it's not enough, test it somewhere else. So I'd like to see a world where things are tested. As soon as you leave that world, it's just blah, blah. I can't find any way to agree with anything that isn't come up with an idea, test it, and measure it. If you're not doing that, you're not doing anything I care about. I would love to see a candidate who just says, I don't even have an opinion. I'm going to go with the majority on social issues, just because that keeps things, you know, calm. And if it's economics or world stuff, and I can test it, I will.
Libertarians tend to think that, you know, that's why you leave as many things to the marketplace as possible, because that's where ideas are actually tested. You have written that the paradox of capitalism is that adding a bunch of bad-sounding ideas together creates something incredible that is far more good than bad. What led you to that conclusion?
The amazing thing about the economy and capitalism in general is that most people are failing most of the time. 9 out of 10 new businesses fail, but while they're failing, there are people working for them. They're buying things from vendors. And even the things that are succeeding are only succeeding until they don't, right? So everything is a failure in progress. They just have temporary successes sometimes. So the genius of capitalism is that it not only survives that failure, but it's built upon it. All that activity creates economic goodness for everybody, even though on the surface you could score a lot of it as a failure.
A lot of people might be surprised to hear your generally good feelings towards capitalism, given that that Dilbert, at least on the surface, kind of reads like an indictment of it, of forcing everyone into this conformist box, a literal box in the shape of a cubicle. Is that a misreading of Dilbert?
Capitalism falls into that category of things which are terribly flawed, but nobody has a better idea yet. Probably the better idea will be some form of capitalism with some kind of controls, I would imagine. So when I talk about Dilbert and his life, that's really on the individual level. If you're an individual within capitalism, you could have a terrible life, but you could also have a wonderful life if you're lucky and you're born in the right places and you do the right stuff. So capitalism is a mixed bag, and I write about some people who are not having the best of it.
Before creating Dilbert, you were a kind of Dilbert working at Pacific Bell in some other corporate environments. You use your experience there as a template of what you call failing towards success. Could you talk about that idea?
So the idea of failing towards success is really that if you pick your projects carefully, then even in failure, you're going to increase your odds for something good happening later, all right? So I make the distinction between a goal-oriented view of life, where you say, this is the one thing I want, and you focus on that to the exclusion of other things. But sometimes, if you don't hit that goal, you're not really in a better position for some other thing, all right? So I pick projects where, when they fail, I'm smarter. I've learned something. People have met me. I've networked. There's something about the situation that puts me in a better situation.
You were possibly the first cartoonist to put his email address on the actual comic strips. And you say that it actually revolutionized the comic strip and was a huge boon for your career. Tell me about the decision to do that and what happened after.
Well, it sounds so quaint from the perspective of today. But including my email address in the margins of the strip seemed radical at the time, because there was thinking that it would be viewed as an advertisement of some sort. So if you could even think back to when email was so new that people thought it was more of an advertisement than a communication. Dilbert was not terribly successful in those days. I was sort of on a failure vector at that point. I wasn't in enough newspapers that it could have been sustained. So I had a little freedom, the freedom that failure gives you. I have an MBA and, you know, I'm an economics major. So I've got a lot of businessy background, and cartoonists typically didn't use any business principles. So the biggest, most important one, you know, number one, is you got to open a channel to your customers and say, how am I doing? And if you're not doing well, you got to change something, right? It's the most basic thing any business does. No cartoonist had ever done that. There was always the cartoonist sends it out and it goes through channels and it shows up in the newspaper and strangers read it and that's all you know. So once I put my email and address in the strip, people wrote in and said, we love it when Dilbert's in the office. We don't like it when he's at home. And in those days, he was mostly at home. And I didn't know that people liked him in the office so much. But it was a pretty clear message, so I made that change. And that was probably the biggest change that made Dilbert successful. Exactly like the business books would say it should happen. I listened to the customers. I changed the product.
And by moving him into the office, it seems that you really tapped into, I don't know, the zeitgeist of what was going on in corporate America at that time, and people really related to it. And now there's been some self-conscious changes away from the cubicle farms to these like open floor plans, and you can telecommute and bring your dog to work and everything. What do you make of today's corporate environment? Is it an improvement, or is it just a repackaging of the same stuff?
Well, you have to be careful, especially in the Bay Area, you know, where I live. You hear about the startups and the open offices and everybody's bringing their dog to work. That is not corporate America. Corporate America is still the cubicle. You know, things aren't changing that quickly. So the startup world is its own whole, you know, ecosystem. That's a whole different deal. I'm trying to incorporate some changes into Dilbert. He doesn't wear his necktie anymore. Yeah. I just sort of silently took that away. And I just put him in sneakers for the first time. You won't see that comic for a month or so. But making small changes to acknowledge that the world moves.
Do you think it's moving in a positive direction, negative direction, or is it just the same, lateral?
Every time there are more options, it's a better world. You can't make people choose options. You can't manage their risk for them. But I think the world has more opportunity both inside a corporation and out than it ever has at any time, and more opportunity for every person in society. So I would say it's the best it's ever been by far.
Is there a theme that runs through all of your work?
There is. And even though it looks like different work, there's I've written books of fiction, there's the cartoon, I've written nonfiction books. But in all cases, I'm interested in the same thing, which is there a different way to look at the familiar? Is there another way to look at the office work situation? Is there another way to look at reality? Is there another way to look at why Donald Trump is doing well? So whenever there's another explanation, I don't even require that to be the better one or the preferred one or even mine. But I find it terribly interesting that you can defend an entirely different view of the world with the same data that's used to defend the standard model. So whenever I can do that, I'm so there. Because as soon as you realize that the model you've been looking at maybe isn't so firm as you thought, then you're free.
You write a lot about persuasion and kind of being able to reprogram people through hypnosis and whatnot. But is there a place for rational discourse?
Is there room for logic and reason in this world? There is, but it's limited. The example I use is if you're balancing your checkbook, which I haven't done for years, but I hear people do it. You're using reason, and if you're doing something that's a very constrained, usually human, artificially constrained situation, logic is really good in that, reason works really well. But in the real world, there are always too many variables. You're just left to your biases. So what we learn in hypnosis is that almost all reasons given for the big decisions in life are rationalizations after the fact. The little stuff like, why did you pick this product over this one? It might have been price, it might have been reasonable. But the big stuff, where do you live, who'd you marry, what decisions do you make, all irrational.
So you just embrace the irrationality.
I do more than that, because the irrationality is useful, right? Once you learn that it is what it is and how to use it and the tools for living in that world, it's completely transparent.
If there's so many competing ideas and they can all be defended about equally, how do you decide which ones to go with?
I don't believe in a preferred view of the world. In other words, I don't believe there's a preferred reality. I'm kind of, you know, cheating. I'm borrowing a sort of an Einstein thought about physics and applying it to our perceptions. But I think anything that doesn't kill you works. In other words, my neighbor can believe that President Obama is a Kenyan Muslim who's destroying the presidency from the inside before he gives Iran the bomb to kill us all. And I could believe that none of that's happening. But we both go to the grocery store and we're standing next to each other and we're buying melons and nobody dies. Right? So there are a lot of competing ideas that just seem to work. They fit the data well enough that you don't die and then they survive. So I guess I would only caution humility about your own view, because I assume that most of my views are wrong because they're different than they used to be, right? And I thought they were pretty right before. So the fact that I'm sure I'm a little bit more right now, probably there's no more data that says I'm right now than I was before and I've changed my mind. So it takes a long time to learn some humility about how much you really know.
Scott Adams, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
For Reason TV, I'm Zach Weissmuller.
What it is a worldview, sort of a filter, if you will, a way to look at the world, to try to understand things that don't make sense with whatever model of the world you were looking at before.